So we, in these two sections, have finished talking about just what are amino acids. I'm hoping that you all are working on memorizing your structures. Your instructor was calling the bet, meaning that I have memorized those structures I've already presented to you, so I'm just waiting for you all to catch up in this one instance. In lab today, section two, we're going to talk about a way of determining the number and kind of amino acids that are in a polypeptide chain. In lecture here today, we're going to talk about how can we determine the sequence of a chain, and I'll talk a little bit more about what a sequence is. Because the next time we have lecture, which will be on Monday, do the math, that means yes, there is no class Friday. I'm not able to get a substitute. And I can't be there, so there will just simply be no class on Friday. So our next lecture will start to get into protein structure, primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary protein structure. And we also, both today and on Monday, need to talk about synthesizing amino acids, which we'll only do at a first pass level because, as we'll see, the synthetic routes we're going to learn have one drawback to them, which is that you make both the D and the L form at the same time. But given time, we're also talking about separating out enantiomers because I never did address how. I might have mentioned that you could with some trickery, but I don't think I ever addressed how you could separate enantiomers from each other. So it seems like the perfect place to do it. So today's lecture, we're going to talk about sequencing, which is determining the order of amino acids in a polypeptide. By the way, I apologize I didn't send the little Twitter or Facebook notice out. The websites are updated. The lectures up through Monday are posted. I'll get this one posted late this evening, and I'll remember to send the announcement this time. So remember that the sequence of a polypeptide itself is expressed from the amino end or terminal or terminus to the acid end. So just to throw something up for purposes of discussion, let's say we had something like, what is the amino acid that the side chain is four carbons with amino group at the end? Lysine. Okay. And what is I don't remember the correct three-letter abbreviation, but what is the amino acid that has a benzyl group as the R group? Phenylalanine, which I'll just call it PHE, guessing. I hope I'm right. And then what about the amino acid, the one amino acid we've discussed so far that has sulfur in it? Cysteine, yes. There's serine and cysteine. Serine is the one that's an alcohol. Cysteine is the one that is the sulfur. And so this would be the sequence if, the three letters abbreviations are correct, lysine, phenylalanine, and cysteine. How could we determine this order? Well, there's a reagent, and the answer is a reagent that we could use to do this. For section two, we're doing this slightly out of order because normally I should talk first about how we could identify just how many amino acids there are. But that's what will be coming in lab lecture. For both section 2 and section 1, to give this some context, to determine the types and number of amino acids we have, we could completely decompose this chain. In other words, if this polypeptide is nothing more than a series of amide linkages, undo the amide linkages, which you could do by hydrolysis, so subjecting the solution to strong acid, concentrated solution for a long period of time at elevated temperatures. Which means you would lose any order that the amino acids had been in. So that wouldn't give you sequencing, that would just allow you to know the proportion of amino acids in a polypeptide chain. So what I'm going to show you here is how we really could, one amino acid at a time, determine the structure of a polypeptide chain. And the reagent that we're going to look at is phenylisothiocyanate, which is used in the Edman degradation. Now, I'll be sending out a handout that has the full mechanism of what we're about to discuss. I will not be asking for that full mechanism because I think it's 8 rounds of protonate open attack deprotonate, which, although the mechanism might be interesting, that technically is a Chem-12B topic, or we could say the beginning of this quarter when we're doing carboxylic acids and such. So what I really care more about is the transformation of functional groups that are going to occur, and just we need to know that there's a whole bunch of protonate open attack deprotonates, because what it really comes down to is a series of tautomerizations and ring opening and closings. So the Edman degradation uses this reagent, phenylisothiocyanate. Which I'll abbreviate henceforth, it's PITC. It has this structure. Actually, before I write the structure, let me remind us that when we studied the Curtius and Hoffman rearrangements, we saw isocyanates. So does anybody remember what the general structure of an isocyanate is? I hope you do by the time of the final, since we have not had any quiz or exam questions about the Curtius or Hoffman rearrangements yet, have we? Yet. Given that the crickets don't seem to have consensus on this answer, that's an isocyanate. Which, just as a refresher, when we react this with something like water, we're going to end up with a carbamic acid. Remember, we have carboxylic acids, and then we have these that are nitrogen substituted. They're carbamic acids. Do you happen to remember anything special about carbamic acids? They decompose. So that's why at this point one carbon is lost. And so remember, this is partly a refresher for the Curtius and Hoffman rearrangements. Remember that whatever compound you start with, you effectively lose a carbon during the process. Now, isothiocyanates. Those isothiocyanates mean substitute the oxygen with a sulfur. Aside from just, oh gosh. Aside from just trying to remind you that we have these two rearrangements that I want you to know, I'm also trying to remind us, how does the carbon in the middle of these two hetero atoms react? If you look at this, this is kind of like the sulfur equivalent of a ketone fused simultaneously to an imine, which is why we end up with this carboxylic acid style derivative. So, in other words, what I'm about to react with this is going to attack at the carbon that's in the middle of the molecule. What am I going to react with this? Well, let's take a generalized amino acid chain, a polypeptide. I'm going to not include stereochemistry because, as we will see, it won't matter. I'll show two amino acid units. And I'll simplify the rest of the structure by just saying that the rest of the chain is beyond this last amide linkage. All right. And now at the end of the chain, of course, is a carboxylic acid. But is a carboxylic acid likely to be the thing that attacks this phenylisothiocyanate, other than maybe providing a proton source? No. So what if this molecule is more likely to react with the phenylisothiocyanate? This is where you're using some of your chemical intuition. What's that? So actually, we don't have a carbonyl. We have a, what would that be called? Not sulfonyl. Maybe sulfonyl. The carbon-sulfur double bond, is that what you're trying to get at? Or are you trying to say the carbonyl on the, over here? But that carbonyl is part of an amide. And amides are not very reactive functional groups. What made you think that, though? What's your logic behind that? Okay, like an imine formation or something like that?
Yeah, something
like that. Okay. Let me ask this question, the whole class. Would this compound more likely be a Lewis acid or a Lewis base? Okay, so what is a Lewis acid? Something that accepts a lone pair, what's a Lewis base there for? Something that donates a lone pair. Sulfur could donate a lone pair to something. It could alkylate, for example, if we had an alkyl halide. Do we have anything that would want to be attacked on this the polypeptide chain, though? Because if we call the phenylisothiocyanate a Lewis acid, you just said base, sorry. So it's providing a lone pair. Where would the lone pair attack on the polypeptide? While you're thinking about that, let me push this again a little bit more towards the answer. What about the reverse? What argument could you make that the phenylisothiocyanate is actually a Lewis acid, which means it's going to want a lone pair? Isn't there a fairly good-sized delta positive right here at that carbon? And then we have a base. Remember, the amines are bases. So, in fact, the first step of the reaction here is that the amine attacks that carbon exactly like water over here attacks isocyanate. And so what's produced is this. So here is the phenylisothiocyanate. Here's where it shows up in the product. Here is a thiourea. So urea is a carbonyl with nitrogens on either side of it. The compound urea itself would just be a carbonyl with amino groups on either side. This is a thiourea because it's got sulfur there instead, and it's actually a thiourea derivative since we have substituents attached to the nitrogens. That's not such a big deal in this other than to point out that's what that functional group is. We don't stop here, though. And here's where the first tautomerization occurs. The nitrogen, not next to the benzene ring, could, in theory, make a carbon-nitrogen double bond if we were able to push the sulfur-oxygen double bond open. Why might that happen? Well, because in this with this reagent, if you're under acidic conditions, maybe somehow the amide over here could get opened up. So this is not a set of mechanism errors. This is just a set of transformations that are going to occur. That lone pair pushes open the carbon-sulfur double bond, which can attack the carbonyl that's over here, making a five-membered ring, which that's part of the reason this is not, as I won't say favorable, but possible, because you're making a five-membered ring, which is not unfavorable. Pushes the carbonyl open, a proton comes from somewhere, and we end up with this next intermediate. Now, look at what we have here. This that I've just circled would be somewhere between an amide and a carboxylic acid. So, I know this might be tough to do, but visualize for a moment a carboxylic acid. Imagine that you did one cycle of protonate open attack the protonate, somehow adding an amine in. Of course, in real life, amines and carboxylic acids just neutralize each other, but just pretend. So if you had a carboxylic acid, it has carbonyl and OH group. Push open the carbonyl, now you've got oxygen and oxygen. Something else attacked it, that would be a nitrogen. Now switch to sulfur because it acts a lot like oxygen, and that's exactly the situation that we have here. So in other words, what would want to happen is a carbonyl would want to form one way or another because having these three heteroatoms to that carbon makes it a particularly reactive carbon. That's the justification for what happens next, which is that, again, effectively, this ring closes. Again, I'll switch to using blue, try to broadcast this is not mechanism that's going on. But here's the big important point. At this point in the mechanism, the remainder of the polypeptide chain is ejected. That means that whatever next I'm going to show has the R group from that first amino acid that's now been separated from the rest of the chain. That means that we are sequencing because we were able to pull just the first amino acid away. Now, we're not quite done because we need to get to the point where we have what we can isolate and analyze from this. So, next stopping off point is this structure, which is a five-membered ring that contains an imine, a carbonyl, and in the ring itself, a sulfur. This is known as a thiazolamide. So the azole part of the name means five-membered ring with nitrogen. The thia means sulfur, one means ketone. So thiazolinone means five-membered ring with a nitrogen and a sulfur and a carbonyl in it. And, again, it has this R group. Now, the problem is, it's not a problem, but we're not done because this is going to open again, the ring, and it's going to close. When it opens, we're going to make effectively a carboxylic acid over here, so it's like hydrolyzing this thioester. And let's just see what that looks like, and then I'll show you what's going to happen next. As part of the opening of this, we're going to have water come in and hydrolyze this. The carbon-sulfur bond is going to come back over and push this open. And so effectively, in other words, we're doing another tautomerization. So the first tautomerization was as a response of ring closure. The second tautomerization is in response to ring opening. Notice we're back to a thiourea when we do this. And now, the last bit, we make an amide, where the nitrogen that is closer to the benzene ring finally gets involved and makes a 5-membered ring by combining with that carbonyl. The end result. Nitrogen R group. There we go. Now allow me just a moment to make sure I've got this structure correct, because this is the first time I've done it from memory completely. It. I know it's in your chapter. Here we go. Note synthesis, ion exchange, electrophoresis, anhydrin. Section 23.13, I think. There we go. Yes, now let's see. Yes, it is correct. Thank goodness. This is known as a phenylhydantoin. Where that name comes from, I don't know. But this can now be isolated. Each one of these is going to be different depending on the R group, which is going to depend on the amino acid removed. You identify which amino acid had been here, and you get the first amino acid in the polypeptide chain. You do the reaction again. Pull the next amino group off. Do it again and again and again and again. Identify each one of the amino groups, and you've now sequenced the polypeptide chain. Yes?
I mean, I'm just curious. Do you have that last step, or can you isolate the thiazole?
I'm guessing that having the effective structure of a thiourea here, along with having a thioimide, is thermodynamically more stable than having a thioester with this functionalized imine.
So when you say thermodynamically stable, that just happens.
Right? Yes. It's kind of like, I guess what I'm trying to say is the thiazole known is the super complicated equivalent of an enol when looking at the hydantoin. Yes? Where does the carboxylic acid come from? Where? Oh, because you can presume water's in this reaction environment. Really, it doesn't even necessarily have to become a carboxylic acid. This is for simplification. When you see the handout that's got the full mechanism, you'll see that actually we get to something that would otherwise look like a hydrate. But since anything in equilibrium can and will happen, that means there's some portion of it that would exist as the free acid instead. It'll make more sense when you see the mechanism. Yeah. Hydantoin. I know you would expect me to say hydra or something like that. And let's see if it even names it here. It says pH. Okay, it calls a phenylthiohydantoin. So let me throw that in. I'm not familiar with what hydantoins are. I was never a heterocycle chemist. If I can find any good reference about what they are important for, I'll let you know. So let me put down in text some summarization of this. Phenyl isothiocyanate, PITC, can be used to pull one amino acid residue off of a polypeptide chain. One and only one from the amino terminus of that polypeptide chain. The derivative formed, the PTH, the phenylthiohydantoin, can be identified the identity of that amino acid. Yeah. Gosh, Children, don't make me pull the lab over. The identity of the amino acid can be determined from the PTH derivative that results. The process can then be repeated to fully sequence a polypeptide chain. Or at least, in theory, because if you have a reaction that's 99% successful, the 99 to the 25th power, 99% to the 25th power is... only 77.8%. So if you had something that was 99% successful and effective and didn't produce byproducts, apply it 25 times, you're down to the point where really overall it's only 78% successful, which means you keep doing it and you can no longer be confident enough that what you're sequencing is correct. Now over time, the number of repetitions that this can be used for has increased, but there are also newer techniques of sequencing that have been invented. I've not ever had the opportunity to take a biochem course, so I can't speak very well to those other methods of sequencing, but they're outside of the purview of this course anyway. So this is the one reagent we're going to learn. Maybe a second one we'll learn. There's a couple of specific amino acids that can be targeted by other agents, and maybe we'll review those agents on Monday. But this is the main sequencing technique I wanted to show for today. So any questions on this one? How many of you have read the chapter? Wow. You all just like making this painful for yourselves, don't you? Okay. Now, we do need to return to the question of chromatography in lab for section 2, and that means we're also going to wrap up electrophoresis in section 2. Other than those topics, though, does anybody have any questions from any previous material that we've covered regarding amino acids? Then let's talk about synthesis of amino acids. We've talked about how to synthesize things from amino acids, but we haven't talked about the synthesis of amino acids. Your text does not go terribly in-depth into this topic, and that's just author's personal preference. Some authors go way deep into this and give you all kinds of routes. So I'll just show you the couple that the text gives you, and I'll start with one that's a variation of the malonic ester synthesis. Yes, again, back to the carboxylic acid chapter. This, in fact, uses alpha-bromomalonate as the starting material. So diethyl alpha-bromomalonate could be one starting material. Before I proceed any further, can this compound undergo SN2 reactions? What kind of alkyl halide is this? Secondary. Can secondary alkyl halides undergo SN2? Yes. Oh, which reminded me of something. I keep forgetting and forgetting and forgetting to talk about the ACS exam. So let me finally talk about that. The ACS exam is a standardized exam that is prepared by the American Chemical Society that is used purely as a diagnostic tool. It is not like the SAT where there's a centralized agency that administers the exam, nor, without your permission, do we share any information from the results of that exam with anyone except who you tell us to. We may take a class cumulative scoring to send that to the ACS because they do keep track of what are known as national norms. In other words, everywhere across the country that administers the exams, if everybody self-reports back the cumulative results, then we find out across the country how many students scored which kind of scores on which questions. Each question theoretically was designed with one specific intent or learning outcome in mind. And so it's a way to assess at a certain depth what the preparedness of an organic chemistry class is at one institution versus everybody else's. That's what it's for. As far as you individually, why would you want to take this? See how you compare to these national averages, which is a reflection both of how you studied, but also what I did to present the subject. The real reason some of you might want to take it is that there are select institutions, not everybody. The biggest example I can think of being Berkeley, where Berkeley has two OChem tracks, Chem 3A and B, which are the pre-med version, and Chem 112A and B, which are the chem majors version. I was a TA for the 3A, 3B version, and can tell you that the difficulty level of that course is not that much different from this course. My understanding is that the chem majors version had a much more sophisticated lab because they had much more sophisticated resources available, but content-wise, lecture-wise, wasn't necessarily that different. Because of that, and because of another, I know this is a long story, but you should know the full background, there is this total crap system that we have I prefer to use the slightly sanitized words, so I can tell you what I really think about it. Where OChem is classified as an upper division course at OChem, but everybody on the planet that's a chemist takes it as a second year course, or if you're a Wunderkind, then you take it as a first year course. So why they call it upper division must mean nothing more than this. I'm presuming that they get more remuneration, not as instructors, but as a campus, for the more upper division courses that are taught. Chem 112 AB is an upper division course. Chem 3AB technically would be lower division. So from here, De Anza, you articulate directly to the Chem 3AB course at Berkeley. Unless the chemistry department has its agreement that if you score 75% tile, which if you all have been, it's been so long since you've taken standardized exams, percentile doesn't mean you get 75% correct. It means you do better than 75% of the people everywhere. So if you get 75% tile or higher, then they'll give you the Chem 112 AB credit if you transfer, I think, specifically to the chemistry department at Berkeley, or something like that. So that's why some people take the ACS exam. Otherwise, it's optional, and just to give you an overview, because it's a multiple choice exam, but it's a reasonably well-written multiple choice exam that does cover synthesis, mechanism, stereochemistry, spectroscopy, including NMR. Ooh, yeah. And SN1, SN2, aldehydes, ketones, a little bit of everything. Obviously not to the depth that my exams would give, but better than I would have expected from a multiple choice exam. There are study guides available. I don't make them available. They used to be super duper secret until the company itself started publishing them. So, here is the question. When do we want to do it? Because it can't be part of our normal class time, because it can't be used as a final in this class, because it covers more than a quarter's worth of material. It covers all of OChem. My suggestion would be the first or second day or something like that of the first week of summer class. Or the Friday after... No, wait. This is... We have our final on Thursday... So it's the other section. I think that might be Thursday. So maybe that Friday. So it... No. So here's what I want you to go off and do. Look at the schedule of your classes and finals during finals week of this quarter in the first or second week of summer school. Pick three dates you like, and we're going to come back and figure out a date. I may be willing to do a second date. I will not be willing to administer the exam after that point my own self. The question's already come up. Can I go to someone else and take it? I don't know yet. I got to figure out what the ethics of that are. Can you retake it? No, because I'll make sure anybody teaching OChem won't give it to you. Because that I don't think is ethically correct. Because it's this, we only have one version of the exam. I think I've addressed all the issues that tend to come up around the ACS exam. Has anybody got any questions about the ACS exam? Okay, I thought that because I was thinking about SN1s and SN2s and thinking, wow, did they forget all that? So, can this undergo E2? Why not? No hydrogen at the right position. You have two carbonyls there. You need a hydrogen one position away from where the leaving group is in order to do elimination. We never did talk about carbene formation, but that's something different. If you don't know what one is, that's okay, in a sense. Although, for those of you taking the ACS exam, now that I've said that word, you might want to go look it up. Again, some textbooks get all into carbines. Some just say, here's one, and then move on. We never covered it because even if it's in your textbook, I would say, okay, here's one, let's move on. Back to this synthesis so we can finish this off. What would have happened if I took that and then took thalamide? We all remember what thalamide is, of course, because that's the compound used in your Gabriel amino acid synthesis. Of course, I like that. Yes. Of course. Well, you know, you've done a Gabriel already. Now, what if we took the anion of it? You know, neutralized it with potassium hydroxide. Is that a particularly acidic proton that would need to be removed? The other way of asking that question is this thalamide salt a really strong base? Compared to what? Compared to hydroxide, is it strong? The answer turned out to be no, because that nitrogen is in resonance with two carbonyls, so my recollection is the pKa is about 15 or something like that for that hydrogen, something down around the level of where hydroxide's conjugate water would be. The whole point of all of this is to explain that, yes, this is a perfectly reasonable reaction, that the thalamide salt will do an SN2 reaction on the alpha bromomalonate. Which still has a hydrogen at the alpha position. If we were to make a logical choice of bases, for example, if we were to use sodium ethoxide to match the fact that we have an ethyl ester, and if we introduce an alkyl halide, we could then end up, this will be the last time we write this big, huge structure, we end up with this, which looks like a combination of things. It looks kind of like the Gabriel amine synthesis, and it looks kind of like the carboxylic acid synthesis from the malonic ester synthesis. Well, that's because this is an amino acid. So we're doing something that would give us the amino group. At the same time, we're doing something that's going to give us that acid group. At this point, we can hydrolyze. And it's going to hydrolyze a whole bunch of stuff. It'll hydrolyze the thalamide and release this amino group. That's how we get that alpha amino. It's alpha amino because we stuck it on in the first place by combining it to this malonic ester. When we hydrolyze the malonic ester, we're going to get a beta keto ester, or beta carbonyl containing acid, actually, not ester, acid. That decarboxylates, so what we're left with is our customized amino acid. The only drawback being what I mentioned earlier, the fact that we're going to end up with a mix of enantiomers. Now, let me double-check what the other syntheses were in your text. And this would be in section 23.6. Let's see how much time we got left. You know, I'll just do this next time on Monday, so we're not trying to squeeze this in. Questions? Yes?
For the second set, the RX set has to be primary?
Primary, yes. And so one more time. No class 6, 8, 12. Yes. Yes. Right now I'm currently planning for the exam to keep its currently planned date of the 15th. Friday of next week, and it will cover only the amino acid chapter.
Chapter
23.